Let me say this as clearly as I can. Listen up, financial advisors. Hup, there are people out there who are able to deliver the same or better service, charging clients much less in a different way. And they're not robo-advisors. This is a customized wealth management service. And so today we are going to talk about the evolution of flat fee pricing, and you better listen. Hey, what's up, party people? It's me, Sarah G with the Smack, and I'm back. I am a CFA charter holder, and I used to be a financial advisor. On this podcast, I provide non-BS oriented, straight up views on LinkedIn and other financial advisor marketing topics. You can't get this anywhere else, people. So if that's of value, then please subscribe. And if not, then please leave this podcast right now. Does doing the right thing by clients mean you have to earn less money? Does earning less money mean you're doing the right thing by your clients? My position on fees is this. I think it depends on how it's done and on the moral compass of the individual. I've seen very good hybrid advisors who are doing great for clients and charging them commissions. And I've seen very bad fee-only advisors who are giving their clients a bad deal, even though they're fiduciary in the whole ball of wax. Okay, so there is no absolute here. But for the future, I do believe it would create a profession, not an industry, but a profession consisting of professionals, if advisors were to charge by the hour or by a flat fee. Even if charging flat fees is of no interest to you as an advisor, you should still listen to this podcast because I am seeing more and more advisors go hourly or go flat. Just my anecdotal experience here. And you will be competing against this pricing model in the future. So you need to know how it works. And in this particular advisor's case, he does an impeccable job and he would be kicking your butt if you went head to head with him. So Andy Panko is a flat fee advisor and the founder of Tenon Financial. Welcome to my show, Andy.
Hi, welcome. Thank you for having me. Super excited to be here and share my story.
So there was this post I did last week on LinkedIn and it went something like this. It was one of those quote posts, right? And Andy, I know you know this because you comment on these things when I do this, but it was like, financial advisor says, I'm a fiduciary. I do right by my clients 100%. Consultant. And this actually is a conversation I have all the time. Consultant, would you ever consider charging hourly or flat fees? Financial advisor, that's out of the question. I won't make as much money. And it kind of created this big wave because people always have very emotional responses. I guess I pushed a few buttons here, and people love to swoop in on these talks. So Andy, let's start with a basic question. What is a flat fee advisor?
That's a great question. And it blows my mind how many other advisors in the industry have no comprehension about it. So I posted on LinkedIn, on Facebook, seeking other advisors who charge a true flat fee for a bundled financial planning and investment management offering. And I got a few dozen responses because I'm looking to create a list of referrals to freely share with prospective clients. And I got a few dozen responses, probably three quarters of them, the people clearly didn't understand the concept of flat fee. They said, yes, I'm flat fee. And then I look at their ADV, you know, the regulatory filings, or I look at their website and it says they charge a fixed fee for planning and then a percent of assets under management for investment management. And I'm like, no.
Not a flat fee advisor.
Not a flat fee advisor. So really, people don't understand it even within the industry. To me, how I offer it, how I idealistically envision the industry hopefully going, is a flat fee is simply that. Whether you charge $6,000 a year, $10,000 a year, $20,000 a year, that's your fee. The amount of assets the client has under your management does not matter because I'm sure we'll get into this, but it's investment management, even good investment management, is super scalable, increasingly cheap, easy, and commoditized. And the size of the assets really has virtually zero bearing on the amount of time, resources, expertise needed to properly implement and service a client relationship inclusive of investment management.
Okay, so hold on, Andy. Let's just go back over that because that was so much. And thank you very much for your good definition. A flat fee advisor is defined as an advisor who, for one set fee, which is either incurred on a monthly or a yearly basis, does it have to be monthly?
No. And let me back up a little. I'll preface this whole conversation by saying there is no perfect or 100% right or 100% best fee model. I'll freely admit that. I get on my soapbox a little too much. I beat the drum a little too hard about the merits of flat fee because it works for me and what I do and how I do it. But no fee model is completely free from inherent conflicts of interest. No fee model is perfect in all scenarios. But what I do, it is a true flat annual fee. I choose to have it deducted from clients' accounts quarterly. Whether you do it monthly, whether you do it once a year, doesn't frankly matter. The point is the total fee that the client pays every year is fixed. It's hard-coded into the advisory agreement. There's no ambiguity. There's no ups or downs.
Wait one second there. Does it adjust for inflation?
In my case, no. Now, I struggled with this. So I've had other folks who do eventually figure out or understand this flat fee thing I do, other advisors, and be like, you're dumb to not charge inflation because there will be inflation over time, yet my fee is going to stay fixed. And my response is, yes, true. I get it. And I maybe to an error, I really value simplicity and cleanliness. So I want clients' fee to be X. I don't want to say, okay, next year it's going to go up 2.1% and now their fee is like X and change. The handshake agreement I have with the clients is the fee is hard-coded to the dollar in the advisory agreement. And it stays that until both of us mutually agree to change it. So what I tell folks is maybe it'll be 3 years, maybe it'll be 5 years down the road, but I may come to you at some point and say, hey, there's been a lot of inflation. I'd like to increase my fee to X. Are you okay with that? Client can say, yes, sure. In which case we amend, mutually amend the advisory agreement. My new fee is now something higher. Or client says, absolutely not. In which case I have to go back and be like, okay, do I continue working for the same flat fee? Or do I part ways if I feel like I'm that underpaid? Now, my thought is this isn't an exact science. What's to say the fee I'm charging is the unequivocally right fee and therefore it needs to have an inflation adjustment? Maybe my fee's low, maybe my fee's high. I don't know. It works for me. It feels mutually fair. I don't feel the need, not to say inflation increases or nickel and diming, but I don't feel the need to have to nickel and dime clients every year. If and when I feel my fee is that far disjointed from the reality of what prices in the world are and what the fee should be, then yeah, then I'll seek to increase it. But otherwise, I don't want to have to do this thing year by year.
Okay. So a flat fee advisor, in some cases, they may say I'm flat, but I adjust for inflation. You don't say that. Okay, fine.
Correct.
So let's just kind of spell it out for people, Andy. And I'm sorry to have to belabor this point, but like you, I have found that advisors really don't understand. Like because there's so many different dimensions here. Okay. So I just want to spell it out. So what about pass through fee? Like, do you pass any fees through to them?
Great question. So the investments in which my clients purchase through me as the discretionary investment advisor, they pay those underlying fund expense ratios. So I'm a passive approach, use a few different pooled investment vehicles, typically exchange traded funds. So there is a built-in exchange expense ratio. The things
right,
I use
in the fund, whatever
in the fund, exactly. And they're all below
out of their assets.
Exactly. There's no way to avoid those, unfortunately, unless you do, not to get too off on a tangent here, but like direct indexing, where you can try to replicate a index of 1,000 positions by owning 1,000 individual securities. But that's super labor intensive. So clients indirectly pay the expense ratios of the funds, which are less than, 10th of a percent for the funds I use. So there's that. Custodial fees.
They pay the trading fees, comes out of their assets, but that goes to the custodian.
Correct. Well, the because I use ETFs, there are no explicit trading fees. So you can buy and sell all day long. Not that I'm in and out all day long, but clients, when I do rebalance their portfolios or initially invest them, there are no direct trading costs to buy or sell ETFs because they trade like stocks and virtually all custodians now waive transaction fees to buy and sell stocks. There is a bid-ask spread. This gets kind of technical. Bid-ask spread, because ETFs trade like stocks, you can buy them intraday throughout the market. The price is simply whatever buyers and sellers are willing to agree upon. And there's going to be, the price at which someone wants to buy is going to be lower than the price at which someone wants to sell. So there'll be a little bit of slippage. Now, part of the way I try to help minimize that is the funds I use are really large, lots of assets, lots of liquidity,
yep.
Lots of trading volume. So bid ask spread is going to be negligible.
That's right.
Plus I'm not day trading, I rebalance once a quarter. So frankly, I don't even have a way to measure the bid ask spread slippage, but it's over the course of, years, it's going to be negligible at best, right. At worst. So there's that cost. And then there's no direct custodial fees. There's no charge to open or maintain accounts. I currently use TD, which will be Schwab. There's no fee to transfer assets in charged by TD or Schwab. There are some typical sort of nickel and dime fees. If the client overdrafts an account, if the client wants to send a wire, I think there's fees. If the client wants a margin loan, obviously, then there's interest going to be charged on that. But normal course of business, no, other than the expense ratios of the funds they're in. And again, trading fees are non-existent unless client has mutual funds that they transferred over that I need to sell out of for them. Then there's typically a $24 per trade fee on mutual funds. Outside of that, no, the only fee they're paying is my annual fee, which is clear as day. I send an invoice every quarter and the fee comes out of their accounts and they can see it there.
Okay. So this includes investment management and financial planning.
100%. And that's the important thing to know that most advisors don't get. They'll say, I'm flat fee, but they're bifurcating financial planning, in which they're charging whatever, $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 a year, fixed, flat, plus a percentage of assets if clients choose to have that advisor manage their assets. So ultimately, clients paying, let's say, $5,000 for planning, plus whatever, half a percent of assets under management. Clients got $1 million. That's another $5,000 right there. And that investment part, the fee attributable to the investments is not flat. It's going to go up and going to go down as the client's investments go up and go down. So me, flat fee is truly, my fee is X. And I can say it's on my website. It's $8,400 a year for single folks, $9,600 for married. I do have the ability to increase or decrease it based on complexity. But frankly, I sort of pick clients that whose circumstances fit the offering I have and the typical sort of level of complexity I'm looking for in clients. If someone's that complex that I feel the need to charge them $20,000 a year, I'm just going to pass on them and say, no, never mind. So my fee does include investment management, whether you got $1 million or $5 million, the total inclusive fee I'm charging, the $8,496, is the same regardless. Mind blown, right?
So you have discretion over these assets?
Correct.
What about if somebody has a 401k?
I do not have discretion.
But you would manage that and charge a flat fee on it? That would be
no. No. So you technically can't unless there's some sort, I won't name names, but there are some sort of third-party providers and platforms that will let you pipe in trading ability on employer plans like 401ks and deduct your fee from them. I don't do that. 401ks, other employer plans are simply, they are what they are. I'm able to see them because I use a financial planning software that aggregates in all of clients' positions, including things held away from TD or Schwab. So I can see what's in them, including to the to the position level. I will look at them and I can make general recommendations about them, but I am not able to transact trades or do the actual rebalancing or changing contribution amounts. The best I can do is make recommendations to clients. They have to go do it themselves through their 401k login.
But that can still be included in your mandate, even though you do not have discretion.
Yes, like looking over any of their assets, even if they have a retail brokerage account held away that they play with.
It's a held away asset.
It's a held away asset, exactly.
Whether it's Bitcoin, whether it's 401k, whatever it is. Okay.
Whether it's a rental property, whether it's their trading account where they want to day trade like tech stocks, whatever. They have assets and I help review and consider that in their total big picture. It's not solely just, these are the assets at TD or Schwab. This is all I'm looking at. I will not touch anything about the rest of your financial life because My discretionary investment management hat is just TD and Schwab. My broader financial planning is the whole picture, inclusive of pensions, social security, annuities, life insurance they have, real estate, held away assets like employer plans. So those are all things that a good planner should be looking at and giving guidance on.
Why did you decide to set up your practice this way? And I mean, tell the story. You've only been at this. You've been enormously successful within how long? 3 years?
A little over two. So I think, yes, I think you have to know my backstory for this to all sort of make sense. So I graduated college in 2000, went to school for finance, wanted to be what I thought an advisor was, and I didn't know what that looked like, but I wanted to help people make money decisions, basically. And while I was in my junior or senior year of college, I interviewed at all the big places that were interviewing on campus for roles they called quote unquote financial advisor. And it was a few different large insurance companies that everyone listening has heard of, and a few different large brokerage firms everyone has heard of. Of these five or so things I interviewed at, only one had any sort of non-commission compensation. One of them had a small first-year living stipend. After the first year, that went away. It was pure commission-based. So, and I did multiple rounds of interviews at a lot of these places. And one of them was, you know, give us a list of 30 of your family and friends. And they literally called it dialing for dollars. You know, it's all a numbers game. You make 100 calls, only five of them will say yes to even talk to you. And of one of those, hopefully you close the sale. So the more calls you make, the more sales you're going to get. They were sure to cart me around and have me interview with like the local studs, you know, the 25-year-old hotshot who had grossed $500,000 that year. And he was sure to show me his S-Class Mercedes. It was all just, you know, production and sell and goals and, you know, push product. And it didn't feel right. I knew I wanted to give advice. I never had any thought or illusion of being good at sales. I, you know, no interest in selling in the traditional sense. So after getting disenfranchised by what I thought the financial industry actually was, I gave up on it and stumbled into an actuarial job at a large insurer. So actuarial jobs are the ones doing the analysis and pricing of insurance products, basically. So I did, it was a corporate job. There's no sales, there's no advising. It was a true corporate, you know, behind the scenes, whatever. So I worked for a few years at a large insurance company, did an actuarial job. I helped do some of the management of their general account. So I learned a lot there. And then got my MBA part-time because the place I was at paid 90% for it. So I did that. And with MBA in hand, I left and got another job doing, which I didn't even know existed, derivative credit risk management for trading derivatives with alternative investment vehicles, so hedge funds and things. So most of my career was doing that. I worked at large institutional investment banks and brokerages doing risk management and credit risk for funky derivative trades with hedge funds and private equity funds. But made good money, worked with great people, did some really cool things, but was never really fulfilled and satisfied. And I saw firsthand working with institutional investment managers, how much money could be made when you charge 2 and 20, like in hedge funds, you know, 2% of assets under management plus 20% of profits, just absolutely killing it. And having seen and analyzed so many alternative investment funds, I realized there are some that do really well, not consistently, not all the time, but some do really well. Some are absolute garbage and the rest just kind of like bumble around and don't necessarily do much relative to cheap passive indexes. So anyway, so that my first experience in college sort of set the tone for sales versus advice. The rest of my 19 years of experience kind of set the tone for a percent of assets. You can make a lot of money. And it was 2016. My mom was transitioning towards retirement, trying to figure out Social Security. And I didn't know much about it at the time, but I helped her dig in and research. And like the proverbial light went off over my head. It was like, wow, this is advice. Like my mom getting her Social Security decision right is the most impactful thing she can do for her retirement finances. It's not messing around with some overly complicated 24 mutual fund, you know, model portfolio that some wirehouse put together that they're charging her 1.5% on with 1% fund expense ratio. It's like, that's not it. It's this advice, right? So that like lit a fire under me to figure out, okay, I'm now re-engaged. Like this caught my attention. I want to figure out a way to help people make decisions like that. And so I just started digging around podcasts and blogs and whatever, and came across, to have to shout out, the XY Planning Network. They are an independent network of advisors who are all fee only, meaning no sales licenses, but specifically they were designed, or kind of common denominator is most people were there to help Gen X and Gen Y, as opposed to just the baby boomers. Now, that's not what I wanted to do. I was squarely interested in retirement. So I still work with baby boomers, or people who will be of retirement age, not Gen X, Gen Y, although Gen X is close to retirement. What fascinated me about XY Planning was the model. It was hourly. It was fee only. It was, you don't have to sell products. You don't have to do percent of assets. There are alternate fee structures. You custom craft the service you want to provide and the fees under which you want to provide it. And that blew the lid off for me. And I was like, yes, this is it. There are ways to do what I want to do, how I want to do it, charge how I want to charge. So I was 2016. I told myself, okay, yep, this is what I want to do, but I want to do it for myself, by myself, offer the services I want to offer, charge how I want to charge. And I gave myself 3 years to save some money, because I realized I'd be giving up a lucrative career and starting from zero. So save some money and further sort of spec out this business, so it's really well thought out, so when I flip the switch on in 2019, I can hit the ground running. So that's what I did. 2016 to 19 was learning, taking a lot of tests, getting designations and credentials, just soaking up everything I could about industry best practices to find out what I like, what I don't like, what I think will work, what won't work, services I want to offer, who I want to work with, really kind of craft my message, my positioning.
Did you take the CFP?
I did, yeah.
That's what, so you took that before you launched the practice while you were working for somebody else.
Exactly. Yep. So on my train rides home every day from Midtown Manhattan to Central New Jersey, every morning in, every night home, I was reading. I did 3 tests in 3 years. I did the retirement income certified professional designation. I did the CFP, and then I did IRS enrolled agent. So all that was just studying on the trains for 3 years straight.
Did you already have kids at that point?
I did. Yeah. So it was a lot of work. I'd leave my office in Midtown probably 6-ish, let's say. And then, I'd have to get to the train station, and then a 45 to an hour train ride home, and then, whatever. And my kids at the time, so 2016 was what, 6 years ago, they would have been 6 and 8. So I was in the thick of it.
So they were like with life. They're in elementary school.
Elementary school, yep.
Yeah. Okay.
So that was it. I knew I needed the designations. I knew I wanted to do as much as I possibly could to set myself up to hopefully have a successful business. And I knew credentials matter to some extent. I knew knowledge obviously mattered. And that was kind of it. So I decided, 2019 would be the year I do it. And sure enough, 2019, I left my old job and started this and haven't looked back.
Right. So, I like this because I think a lot of people, when they think about starting an RIA firm, that's all that they do, is they think about starting an RIA firm. It's never as well planned and calculated and doing things and researching and contacting XY. It's like people are like, oh, I'm not happy with my corporate job. I'm going to quit. I want to do this. And then they're like thinking about it, and then they even quit. And sometimes they're like, I'm thinking about starting there. I'm thinking, and it's like,
right.
They think about it so notionally, but then they don't think about, well, how would I actually do it? What licenses would I need to get? And should I get these before I can my paycheck, right?
Exactly.
And so you got a leg up on the whole thing because you had like visualized the path kind of beforehand.
Yeah, and not just the path of the business, but even personal life. It doesn't matter how good your business idea is. If you have zero revenue, you have to be aware of your personal expenses, and you have to still maintain personal life. So part of the reason why it took me 3 years from inception, initial thought to actually going live, was I knew I needed to save up money. I my plan was I wanted to go 2 to 5 years, at minimum 2 years, with zero revenue from my business and not have to borrow against my house or dip into my kids' 529. So I just spent a few years just building up a cash stockpile to give myself some runway, because I didn't want to be desperate. I didn't want to have to, take anyone with a pulse and just to get some revenue in the door when I first started my business. I wanted time to build it out properly with the clients I wanted to work with.
Why didn't you do a AUM model?
Fundamentally opposed to it, which is the crux of this episode. So I've always, again, worked most of my career with institutional investment managers, and I knew what goes into their processes, their investment management, their operations, their risk management. And I was like, I don't see how the management of assets is linear in terms of asset size relative to resources needed. There's other things on the periphery that are, the more clients you have, yes, the more work there is, obviously. The more names or investments you're researching, sure, if you're in an active investment management thing where you need an army of analysts because you cover, you know, dozens or hundreds of individual securities, then sure, I get it. But for retail, you know, working with individuals, and I've always invested this way in my own personal life, basic index passive products are all the vast majority of people need. In different allocations, of course, right? Younger, you know, more risk, higher, or older, less risk, typically. And there's tax efficiency to pay attention to. So certain investments are better suited to certain account types, whether it's Roth or traditional IRA or whatever. But outside of that, there's, I mean, any monkey with a computer can do the investment management I do. And it's not a knock on me. It's just that there really are that many good products out there that make it really, again, cheap, easy, and commoditized to do and do well. So I realized I just don't see how a $5 million client is five times more work than a $1 million client, or even twice as much work necessarily. Why are we means testing? You know, investment management is the only industry where the fee clients pay seem to be means tested. Look at other real professions, doctors, right? They don't charge you based on your willingness or ability to pay. Lawyers don't. With one exception. And I thought about this. I was like, well, what about lawyers who defend you or not defend you, but represent you for a lawsuit? They do take a cut of what you win. Like they'll take 30% of your winnings. And I was like, well, okay, that contradicts what I was thinking. But here's what I realized. I think you have a lot of investment folks listening to this. That's pure alpha. If you don't have a lawyer to represent you in that lawsuit, you're guaranteed to get nothing out of it. 100% of your winnings are directly attributable to that law firm doing their thing with you in court. So sure, it makes more sense then that they could and should take a cut of that. But if they're just providing you general guidance about like drafting a will or some other basic advice, it shouldn't be a function of your ability to pay. It should just be this, you know, here's the amount of service and value we're providing, and here's the fee. So investment management, I feel, is the same way. Unless you are truly trying to provide alpha, like uniquely attributable returns that are due to something the investment manager did, then sure, charge on that alpha. But the vast majority of advisors, even those who do claim they have some sort of market beating alpha generating formula, accounts go up and down because of the market, not because something the advisor did. So don't charge on it like you were, you know, uniquely, those gains happen because something you did. Most times they don't. And on the flip side, same thing. When accounts go down, either because markets go down or clients decide to take some money and you know, go pay off a mortgage, the advisor is not doing any less work. So why should the advisor's fee go up and go down based on asset size? No, the advisor's fee should be based on the amount of time, resources, expertise, knowledge, whatever provided. And asset size, frankly, has nothing to do with that in the majority of cases.
Andy, you're 3 years into this. What does the practice look like today, as much as you feel comfortable discussing?
Yeah, of course. So from the onset, before I even flipped the switch live, I had a very tight vision of what I wanted, 45 to 50 clients, ongoing relationships, where I'm a true solo. I have no employees and I don't intend to have any at this point. Maybe some point I'll change my mind, but as of now, I don't. So I knew capacity-wise, 40, 50 at most is how much I can comfortably service without stretching myself too thin. So that's what I set out to build. I just announced to the world last week, that I'm no longer taking any new prospect calls. I'm not saying new clients, but new prospect calls. So I currently have about 40 clients. There's another handful of really good calls I had with other folks who haven't yet signed up, but I suspect some will. Some I already sort of pre-agreed to sign up at a future date. So I'm going to be at 45-ish in the next few months, and I'm good. Like that's all I need. I know. Part of why I designed this business the way I did was I know what I want personally out of it. I know what I want professionally out of it. I'm not looking to make $1 million a year. It'd be nice if I did, but that's not my goal. So I'm happy with my 40 to 50 clients. That's all I really want and need in life. And I can properly serve them. They like me. I like them. Hopefully they like me. And that's it. I'm not trying to build an empire. If and when I do let myself get ahead of my skis and start just like hiring and trying to grow for the sake of growing, then yes, flat fee may need to be revisited. Because if I let my overhead get carried away, which I think a lot of advisors do, they got the fancy offices with the wood paneling and the, you know, the receptionist with the impossibly perfect smile who makes your custom cup of coffee and knows exactly what you want when you come into the office. And that stuff all costs money. Do you need to do that to have a successful advisory practice? I don't think so. But if I ever let myself get to that point, then yeah, then maybe I need to start charging more.
But you're doing some pretty intense planning for these clients.
Yes.
Right, on the tax side, right?
Yeah, which I think is necessary. I think it's a huge disservice that a lot of advisors don't do tax planning or flat out can't, especially if you work at a large wirehouse insurance company. That they will tell you in disclosure, we do not do tax planning, which there's tax implications to like virtually every aspect of someone's financial life. So to say you can't do tax planning is a tremendously missed opportunity. Again, investment management isn't the big value add. That's a monkey with a computer can do that well. It's the tax planning. It's the broader planning to tie everything together. That's the real value. So I approach my fee from a perspective of what do I think is fair and what would I be willing to pay for the service and value and things that I provide. So yes, it is management of investments. Yes, it's detailed tax projections. I do with clients like a mock tax return every year to really iron out their income so we can see how much Roth conversion should we do before you hit this tax bracket? Or if you're of Medicare age, you know, are we trying to stay below a certain income to avoid Medicare premium surcharges? I get very, very in the weeds with taxes and even other general planning. So some of my clients have rental properties and I help them talk through and build those rental incomes and potential gains into their financial plans. So I figured, and this is why flat fee makes sense for me. Like I said before, it won't work for everyone. I knew who I wanted to work with, and I know they're all going to more or less be in the same stage of life. They're all going to have the same general planning needs. Like some will have second house, some won't, but whatever. I don't touch people that own businesses. I don't touch people with international planning angles. I don't do special needs planning because that's a whole other area of specialization I know I'm not well-versed enough in. So I choose clients that fit the prototype of who I want to work with. And I know they're all going to generally want and need the same services and have the same planning opportunities. Now, some are a little more involved, you know, I don't want to say need more handholding, but some definitely ask more questions or more inquisitive about the process. So take up more time and that's okay. Whereas others I talk to twice a year and things seem to work fine at that. But I figured, let me come up with a fee that makes sense for the what I'm doing, the time, the resources, et cetera. Assets has nothing to do with it. I can give you examples of where $1 million client is substantially more time and work than a $5 million client. So why should the $5 million client pay more? It's silly and arbitrary that advisors charge on asset size alone.
But how did you come up with what that flat fee should be? I mean, I think you said it was like, what, $8,000 or $9,000 a year or something? Like,
yep. I sort of triangulated a few ways. One was if I were to break down the amount of hours I think I'll be spending with and working for everyone and put an hourly rate to that, what am I sort of shooting for? So I figured, I don't know, $300-$350 an hour roughly. That was one sort of data point I tried to hit for. One was also just the typical client I anticipate working with, what would they pay if they were at the typical 1% of AUM advisor? I didn't want to stray too far from that. I assume my clients would have about $1 million and do the math. That would mean they're paying about 10 grand. And my overhead's low. I'm not trying to be the low cost provider, but I know it's just me in my office by myself. So my expenses are pretty low. So why not pass that on through to folks? So I don't know. I figured, well, initially I sort of undershot. I was charging 6 grand and 7,200 for single and married respectively, not really knowing. And once I started getting clients, things happened pretty fast and furious. I was, you know, 4 or 5 clients a month. It's like, I got to slow this down. I must not be charging enough.
Andy, but let's just cover that. So you get your clients from the internet?
Largely Facebook, yes.
Okay.
Yep.
So I think you told me once you have a, you established a Facebook group.
Correct. Yeah, called Taxes and Retirement. And it's a no sales. It's not like, you know, give me your email and I'll give you this piece of content. There's no lead capture whatsoever. It's just a group people are free to join. It is a private group, so they have to request it in, and that's to screen out like bots and spammers. They can ask questions, and I share articles. I do weekly live videos where I do deep dives into particular topics. I answer questions. I never give specific advice. I don't discuss particular securities. I never cross that line. But general things about tax planning and strategies and retirement planning, it's all free. With people not having to cough up names or emails or not getting added to a list, it's just, here's me, ask. And it's been fantastic because it's a no sales approach. And I think most people appreciate and like that.
Wow.
Yeah. So they found me.
Guys were coming in fast and furious from this Facebook group.
Yep. From the Facebook group. And within a few, I don't know, 6 months, maybe I increased my prices to 72 and 84 respectively. Still didn't slow down. And so, okay, I still must not be charging enough. And then finally landed at 8,400 and 9,600, which is where I'm at now. And that's when I sort of hit what I thought was like a healthy balance of potential clients still reaching out. Not everyone saying yes, not everyone saying no. So I think I hit what felt like the sort of market agreed upon right price for what I offer. And I should say, I believe in capitalism. I don't want to sound like I'm telling everyone you have to charge a certain way, but I firmly feel, and I've seen it firsthand, a lot of my clients, what ended up happening was they have a few million dollars, they're paying 20, 30, 40 grand elsewhere, and they're not complicated scenarios at all. They just, through hard work or good savings or whatever, they have a few million dollars. They realize, like, I don't know what we're getting for tens of thousands of dollars. And I'm like, you're right. I don't get it either. I think you're being overcharged. And I'm not saying that as underhanded dig to try to win business as like the low-cost provider. Again, that wasn't my intention. I just want to offer a service that I feel is appropriately priced. And I did have to kind of rely on the market to help me figure that out. Again, I sort of undercharged initially and then up the prices till I hit an equilibrium that sort of felt right. But that's it. So I have people that are, you know, paying me $9,600 that are paying 30 plus grand before, and they're getting the same, if not better service from me, because I'm doing tax analysis and tax planning, which other places didn't do. Everybody wins. I think so.
What, if you had to say three up and three down, what are the advantages and what are the disadvantages of being a flat fee advisor?
Advantages is, I think it's the least conflicted. So percent of AUM, even though it is, you have to be a true fiduciary, et cetera, we all know there's a huge inherent conflict of interest in there. The interest is that the more assets you have, the more you get paid. It's that simple, and vice versa.
Or the more assets you have, and they're invested for the client as opposed to being in cash.
Correct. Yeah. Right. If you have too much cash, you shouldn't be charging on it. You know, get in trouble if you can. Right. That's a good point. Now, for what it's worth, I think hourly, pure hourly is the most fair, because it most directly ties fees paid to, you know, effort or hours served. But for an ongoing advisory relationship, I don't think it's never going to work, because clients are going to be reluctant to pick up the phone or send an email to the advisor for fear of running the clock and having their fee increase. So I don't think that'll ever truly work for real ongoing advisory. Next, I think complexity-based makes the most sense, where asset size doesn't really lead to complexity. We shouldn't fool ourselves and say it does. Now, at some level, it does. If you have $100 million, sure, you got a whole other host of issues and, you know, estate planning and wealth transfer things that you need to consider more so than someone with $1 million. But outside of that, whether you got $1 to $5 million, asset size alone means nothing in terms of complexity. But I like the idea of complexity-based. The problem is, the more you tweak your model and come up with a model that can accurately reflect every bit of complexity, that model is going to be so unwieldy and clunky that it's going to be a turnoff to everyone. So after that, I think flat fee makes the most sense. Again, assuming you do sort of have a, for lack of a better word, homogenous pool of clients that all sort of want and need the same general stuff. It helps to have a niche, because I'm thinking and doing the same things every day. It's not like I have to spend 20 hours researching something I don't know. If you're not a fit for me because you're not my niche, then I'll say it in the onset, you know, I'm not the right guy for you. So anyway, so flat fee. Tremendously transparent is huge. Less conflict than other fee models. And super simple. Everyone gets it. There's no, even with percent of AUM, I think there's a lot of, I don't want to say, not smoke and mirrors, but clients know I'm paying 1% of assets. but they may not sit down and do the math. They got $2 million. Don't worry about the percentage fee. Look at the ultimate amount of dollars you're paying. That's what matters. If you're paying $20,000 to some advisor who all he's doing is putting you in a, you know, pre-canned 24 mutual fund model portfolio and that's it, you're grossly overpaying. And I can say that with confidence. So those are the three: transparent, less conflicted than others, and super simple. Downside, it's simply not going to work in all things. Like I said, if you're all over the place with the clients you serve and areas of knowledge you have to train yourself in, it's you're going to be scrambling to make sense of this. In which case, I don't.
Andy, I want to just pause there for a minute. In a sense, you are, I wouldn't call you a niche provider, but I would call you somewhat specialized in that you work with folks that are retirement focused and that need that advice on when to take Social Security, how to not get your Medicare premiums increased. And you've garnered these clients from an online strategy that provides information on retirement and seeks those who are looking for those answers, right? So in that sense, you've used a very focused marketing strategy to get to them, right? But most advisors do not. The traditional way that an advisor builds a book is by just getting word of mouth referrals from their clients. And a lot of times that does not translate into a focused book of business. Very often it does not, because if I have a client, if I'm a wealth manager and I have a client who's a lawyer, there's nothing to say that that lawyer is going to refer me to another lawyer. The lawyer is going to refer me to the doctor that they're at the country club with, or their brother-in-law who happens to, or sister-in-law who happens to own a business. And you, for example, said you are not interested in business owners. So there, you know, you have to think about how do I, not just what do I want my business to be and what do I want the focus to be, but how am I going to feed that business? How am I going to form that business and be able to eat by getting those people in that particular area of focus? Am I really equipped with the knowledge to serve them? Do I have a deep enough knowledge to focus on that area of specialization? And do I even want to do that? Like some advisors can't turn people away. Like I tell them all the time, like I have so many people who I've said, they're at capacity. They've got 300 clients. The business is overrun. They've got people working for them. They've got expenses all over the place. And I'm like, you need to streamline this practice. You need to stop working with people with $200,000. Well, that was a referral that came in, or this and that. And I'm like, no, you need to say no.
Right. You definitely need a lot of intention in all aspects of the business. Now, quick backstory. You know, it's almost unfortunate to say, but I think the pandemic was the best thing that could have happened to my business. And here's why. So when I started November 2019 from nothing, I was doing local library seminars. I was taking out centers of influence, you know, local accountants and lawyers to lunch. This was a tremendous flop. I bought a table at a woodworking expo that tours the country and was in the Meadowlands here in New Jersey, because I'm a woodworker and my company name has a woodworking term in it. And I was like, let me go be that guy to hopefully have a unique affinity with all these people in the room. Tremendous flop. But I was doing that stuff, and I knew I wanted to work with retirees, but I would have taken kind of anyone that came along through those typical cast a wide net type of processes. Well, a few months later, a pandemic happened, shut all that down. No more library seminars, no more lunches, no more woodworking shows, thankfully. And so I was home, like, okay, now what do I do? And within a few weeks, that's when I started the Facebook group. I figured I got to get more active online. And I already had a LinkedIn page. I had a Twitter page. I had a Facebook business page. But those are all, you know, Facebook business page is really just a glorified contact us card. It's a brochure. It's not interactive. So I made this group with the intention of, let me just answer questions about tax related, retirement related stuff, hope for the best. And that's what I did. And because online, you know, the reach is global or national, I wasn't limited to just here in New Jersey or New York. So when this group finally started clicking and I got more people joining, more people engaging, more people asking me questions and me just spitting what I know about Roth conversions and Medicare and Social Security and taxes. I think people got comfortable with me. People from all over the country, you know, thousands of people in this group got comfortable with me, and they just started reaching out. I never solicited them. They just took it upon themselves to find me, you know, find my business site, reach out. They thought they wanted to learn more about my paid services, and it just, the rest is history. That's what my marketing was. But I had a very, folk to your point, very focused idea of who I want to work with, what I want to offer. Let me make what I know and don't know painfully evident through this Facebook group, and also to a lesser extent, YouTube channel I have. So people know exactly what to expect from me. They know what I look like, what I sound like, my mannerisms. They know my technical knowledge or lack of. So like the sales process was done. You know, the courtship of them getting to know me was already done before they picked the phone up, because there's so much content of me out there just doing my thing about taxes and retirement planning.
All right. So, but one of the so-called disadvantages of the flat fee model is it won't work for those advisors that can't say no, or that don't want to, or that don't want to really work with people that have some kind of a shared characteristic or interest.
Okay. Correct. Yeah.
Two, what would be the second disadvantage?
Do the math. It kind of cuts off people of lower asset size. You know, someone's got relatively low income, $300,000 of assets. There's no way they're thinking twice about paying someone like me $8,000 or $9,000 when they can go to the 1% of AUM advisor down the street and pay $2,000, $3,000. And I get that. And that bothers me a little bit.
Well, no, they would pay $4,000 or $5,000 because for a
1.5%, right? Yeah.
All the fee only advisors are like, oh, that's a 1.5% or there if you've got under $1 million. Right.
Right.
So yeah.
And I struggle with that. I do genuinely want to help, but I also, you know, I have to view this as a business as well, which it is. So my thought was, and I haven't quite fleshed this out, but think about lawyers. Just because someone can't pay doesn't mean lawyers reduce their fee. No, maybe they have some sort of formal pro bono process. And that's what I envision doing with my own practice at some point. It's kind of once I'm really settled down with my clients and have my annual workflow sort of well ironed out. Because I've only been doing this for a little over 2 years and I just closed capacity.
And Andy, you do have a pro bono kind of a support, because you have that Facebook group where you go on there and you do live things and you give them all this information. And I mean,
to some extent.
If they had to DIY it, they'd have
right.
to DIY it. But if they wanted to, you're nurturing enough of that knowledge in them that they.
Yeah, no, and that's part of why I'll always continue doing that one-to-many type of guidance. It's never going to be advice. You know, in a public forum, I cannot give advice, but guidance, helpful hints, education, whatever you want to call it. I like that. I know a lot of people are getting a lot of benefit and value for nothing, no strings attached. But I do wish I had a better way, and this is where the pro bono thing comes in, where I can actively work with someone, give them tangible, specific advice to hopefully, you know, improve their financial situation. Not just say, not just speak in generalities and sort of vague words like I do in the Facebook group, because I can't cross the line of giving specific advice. So the only way to do that, I don't want to drop my fee to like $1,000 or $2,000 just because. I'd much rather keep my fee as it is and just build out some sort of pro bono program at some point. I don't know. It's just a loose thought in my head. But that's the other drawback, is it simply prohibits people that only have a few $100,000 that they're never going to consider paying me. And I'm okay with that for this reason, because again, I think like any profession, you should be paid for your time, for your expertise, for what you provide. Asset size has nothing to do with it. I'm not working any less if someone has $300,000 than if someone has, you know, $1 million, $2 million. So why should I be compensated less? And same thing on the upside, just because they got more, I'm not working more typically. So why should I charge it more? Hence the flat fee. But it does cut off people of lower income or lower asset size.
And the third one, what's the third drawback?
Regulators don't really get it. Now, this will depend state by state. So I'm registered in my home state of New Jersey, plus a few others where I have, you know, more than the minimum amount of clients. Some states like Washington State, I understand, flat out, the only thing they're okay with is percent of AUM, and, you know, no ifs, ands, or buts, even though you can make a really strong case that percent of AUM is much worse of a model than hourly or subscription or whatever. But whatever, I digress. The states I'm registered in hasn't been a problem. And I think at some point I'll hit the SEC level of assets where I need to register there. And the SEC is okay with it, because I know other advisors who do this flat fee thing. But depending what state you're in, this may be a hard no because your regulator may flat out not allow it. If you're managing investments, they're going to want to see 8% of assets under management.
Then what about maybe as a fourth one, would it be scalability? Like there are some advisors that probably just want to get as big as they can get and they want to hire people and they want to be able to say, I'm an investment manager with $1 billion under management. So that this model, I mean, would it be scalable for them? I think you'd have to, like the position you're in, Andy, like you'd have to hire another advisor because you still have clients coming to you, but you're cutting them off, right? Like you'd have to hire another advisor to take those clients in.
Yeah. And so let's assume I stop it. You know, I get my 50 clients and I'm done and I can properly serve them and I don't need help yet. The second, if I do want to grow, I will need help and I'd have to hire help before growing. The second I hire someone, that right there, you know, my take home, my bottom line is going to drop. I don't know. What's a good junior, 60, 80 grand a year? But I don't know. That's a big ding. But to answer your question, it is definitely scalable. Think about other advisors you know and their practices. What's their average revenue per client? It's probably where I'm at, 7, 8, 9 grand a year, right? Unless they're super high level where they're, you know, because they can be, they're only going after people that are making 20, 30 grand a year. It's probably right where I'm at, right? So they're scalable. I'm no less scalable, right? If every client's bringing in 7, 8, 9,000 per year of gross revenue, it could work just the same, you know, from a scalability purpose. Now, other advisors, and I know why they do it, you know, they go up market simply because they can. Why work with one client making 8 grand when I can work with one client making 20 grand? So that's sort of the natural evolution of a lot of advisors is go up market, clients with higher assets and or higher complexity where they can charge more because the advisor ultimately makes more. But from a pure scalability standpoint, I think you have to look at the average revenue per client and mine isn't drastically different than most advisors out there probably. So I'd be scalable just the same if I wanted to.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. I'm going to end the podcast now, but is there anything I didn't ask you that you wanted me to ask you?
No, just to recap, I am vocal about this clearly. I do genuinely want to help change the industry and really make this flat fee thing, make it get some legs, but there is no perfect fee model. Commission only isn't the end of the world. I think it's the most conflicted, but still there's reason for it. Percent of AUM, you know, everything has its pros and cons. Flat fee is no different. And I'll be the first to admit that. I do think it makes a lot of sense in the right situations though.
All right, great. So Andy, if anybody wants to contact you, how can they reach you?
Man, I would say to my business website, but I'm trying to not get more traffic there. I don't know. LinkedIn, let's just do that. LinkedIn, Andy Panko on LinkedIn. You can go from there. You can message me, go about it that way.
What's the best thing you ever made with woodworking?
Wow, stumped me. A lot of furniture, cabinets, like tables and things like that. I don't have a favorite project. I made this business card holder. I made a little business card holder out of walnut. How about that? I'm sorry, what'd you say?
What got you into this?
I always liked it. My father was super handy and he was remodeling our house when I was a kid. So I was always around different stages of construction and destruction in our house and was kind of naturally interested in always helping him grab tools and clean stuff up. And I don't know, when I got out of college, I got really interested in building stuff, built a birdhouse in the kitchen of our apartment at the time, made a mess with sawdust and then just slowly kind of built up to bigger and more elaborate projects. And now I'm doing like full built-ins, like wall-to-wall built-ins with lights integrated and benches and all kinds of cool stuff.
Is that a side business?
It's kind of a funny story. No, now it's just a hobby, but I did actually quasi leave my old life when I was doing institutional and capital markets banking. I tried to start up a home improvement business because I always thought if I wasn't in finance, I'd probably try to do something with my hobby. And so what I did was I was working full-time at a place. I negotiated with them to work as a consultant 3 days a week. And those other 2 days, I tried to start up my home improvement business and realized quickly, I absolutely hate home improvements as a job. Love it as a hobby, but as a job, it was other people's headaches I didn't want. Yeah. So within a few months, I gave up on that idea and went back to work full-time and no regrets. I'm glad I tried it, but did not want to stick with it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. Well, Andy, thank you so much. You've been a great guest. And everybody,
thank you.
Rate, subscribe, and review my show. And I will catch you next time.